Welcome to the In-Season Podcast, the hunting podcast that brings back the camaraderie of hunting, the campfire conversations about gear, tactics, hunting stories, big bucks, gobbling turkeys, and whatever else might be in season. Whether you're an avid bow hunter, a small game enthusiast, or trying to plan your next big hunting adventure, we are here for it. So let's go. Welcome back to the In-Season Podcast. We have a couple of familiar faces, well, voices for you guys, but a couple of familiar faces and voices from episode 4, where we talked about hog hunting and a little bit of dove hunting. We have the father and son duo here from Georgia, Matt and Luke Graziano. Welcome, boys.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So we asked Matt and Luke to come back on because they've had multiple firsts that have occurred this year. Everything from Matt upgraded his bow and got a chance to, harvest the deer in his backyard to going out of state and shooting the biggest buck of his life. And Luke, how old are you now?
12.
12. You've had a birthday since we talked last, I think, sir. Right? So Luke is 12 and also had a chance to shoot the biggest buck of his life, and I got a chance to be there for it. So we want to talk about all of those things, and then also the four generations that went on a pheasant hunt in South Dakota that you guys had, which was just a really incredible trip. Some of the pictures were awesome, and Luke got on his first bird. Literally, the first day he was legally allowed to hunt in South Dakota for being 12, he got a chance. Pretty cool birthday present. But we'll talk through all of that. But Matt, what just generally, what has the 2023 season been for you?
Yeah, 2023 was it's been a great year. I've said it several times to friends and family. It's kind of been a banner year for me hunting wise.
Last year you were on the struggle bus.
Last year was a struggle, to say the least. Things did not go my way. You and I talk a lot about luck and kind of making your own luck and putting yourself in situations to be successful. I probably didn't do that very well last year, and so things didn't really work out for me. It was a pretty frustrating season.
Well, we haven't talked a lot about your 2022 season. I was there and lived most of it with you.
Yep.
And it was a banner year for me, my best year hunting to date. That's
probably part of why it was so frustrating, is I was with you all season and watched your success, and I'm happy for you, and it was really cool to watch. But a lot of the same, it felt to me like I was trying to do the same things you were doing and learning from kind of your successes and not getting the same results.
Yeah.
And that was probably the biggest thing. It was like, what am I doing wrong? And so I think in the off season, really kind of mirroring a lot of your efforts and learning as much as I can, jumping into podcasts and learning as much as I can about scouting and some of the preseason work that goes into it, really led to a lot more success that I had this year. I talked a little bit about equipment. I think upgrading my equipment, I made that jump this year, got a new bow, one that fit me a lot better. It was a much faster bow. So I felt more confident in my shots. And I put in the work in the off season. I had never really shot a lot of, off season, put in a lot of time for bow shooting, did that this year, and felt way more confident with my bow, which is a big thing.
Prior to upgrading your bow, you were using a bow that was, fairly old and didn't really fit you. For those that don't remember, we've said this before, Matt is a very tall human and has a very large wingspan. And what's your draw length? 32, 33?
It's 32 and a half inches.
32 and a half. Most bows don't even come in that length. Like, there's only certain bows that do, and your bow is probably even more on the target archery side, just from being a longer axle to axle. But before, you'd pull out your bow how far before bow season opened to shoot?
The week before I went out.
Yeah, it was week before. Make sure it's on, and you're good to go.
Yep. Right. Yep. That was the extent of it. Yeah.
And last year in Kansas or Missouri, we went to Missouri last year, and you saw some bucks. You got drawn back, I think.
I tell you how not confident I was, is I brought my compound bow and my crossbow. And I think I said, like, I'm planning on trying to sit with my compound, but if I start seeing stuff that's further, I'll take out my crossbow.
Yeah.
And the last, I think it was the last day or the hunt before the last day. I got on some bucks. I had two bucks that came in, and I wasn't able to execute a shot on them. And so it's like, I had the opportunity, the outfitter did his job. They came within 20 yards of me. I just couldn't pull the shot off.
Part of it, too, was I think some of the preparation and practice, because if I remember correctly, those bucks ended up coming on your weak side, and you hadn't practiced a lot on shooting on your weak side out of a tree stand or out of whatever equipment that might be. And I think that plays a difference of, like, knowing how to move, when to move, and what that is. So what changed?
Yeah, so like, that's an example. That's a good example. So when those bucks came out on my weak side, what what ruined it was I was moving in the stand too much to try to turn and give myself a shot, and they saw me moving, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I was listening to a podcast in the off season, and it was a guy that was talking about, and I've adopted this kind of strategy. He said every deer that walks through the woods when he's bow hunting, regardless if he's going to shoot them, he draws on them. Yep. Just to get the experience of moving, you know, ranging them. Don't forget to range them, how far they are, putting a pin on them, drawing back and holding the draw. And you know, he may bust a few or whatever, but like just the practice of doing that. And so I started doing that. And every deer that walked through the woods, I was drawing back on. And the first four probably, you know, busted me when I was drawing. But after that, you start to figure out when's the right time to draw. You watch them move behind a tree, and then you can draw back quicker. It's just a lot of stuff starts to click.
I've heard that too. Do you remember what podcast that was?
I don't remember.
I don't remember if that was like a Southern Outdoorsman or who it was, but I've listened to that before too. And it's just as much of the process of when to draw and how to do it as any other time. So I think that's that's a great exercise. Also just learning how to hold, learning how to let down, making sure you're ranging, adjusting that way. You're not just picking up your bow for the first time when that big buck comes in and you ruin it. So,
right.
Okay. So walk us through, our season opens mid-September here in Georgia. Even I think leading up to that, you and I had already put a couple hogs on the ground. We had talked about that mm-hmm. on a prior podcast. But what were your expectations going into the 2023 season?
Yeah, so again, having the new bow, my plan was our trip for Kansas was, you know, late October, early November. So the plan was to try to put two deer on the ground with a bow and kind of, you know, as you call them, like the confidence kills to just be comfortable and having done that. So started hunting with a buddy on his, he kind of has basically some in-laws property, 10 acres that's, you know, bow only in the county that's bow only. And so we had a little bit of deer activity. Anyways, I ended up putting down a kind of a smaller buck there and then another deer behind my house with the bow. So pretty quick early in the season, got two deer on the ground.
And with the new bow.
With the new bow.
Yeah.
And so was feeling good about that going into Kansas, you know, at least having put some deer on the ground and, you know, filled the freezer, pressure was off, felt pretty confident with it.
Yeah. And what was the main difference for you? And well, you were shooting an old bear, I think, before, and you upgraded to a bow that actually fit you in kind of this new Hoyt that you have. What was the biggest difference for you there?
Yeah, the fit for sure. The bow I had wasn't fit properly to me. I forgot even kind of where I got it or whatever, but I went to several bow shops, and even the guys at the bow shops too, they were trying to put me in bows that weren't quite what I needed. And I remember going into one where he finally explained to me, I mean, the nose on the string and the whole thing that seems kind of basic, but I hadn't actually felt a bow fit right. And so when I finally got into one that did, it clicked, and I looked at the guy.
Well, it's because like, none of them on the shelf actually will fit you.
Correct. Yeah. And you know, most of the bows that are considered long draw go to 31.5 inches. 32.5 is hard to find. There's only a few that make them. And it's either a target bow or it's like a Matthews and a Hoyt have a long, they consider it a long draw bow.
But aren't always in stock at certain shops.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And so just everything being fit the way it was, you just kind of clicked of what it should feel like. And it also makes it way easier to hold. Like if you ever have been in a bow that doesn't fit you and you try to hold it, you're using muscles that you shouldn't be using. And it's really hard and you shake and everything else. When it feels right, it just kind of goes back in that sweet spot. You can hold it a lot longer. So that was probably the biggest thing for me.
You, in your prior bow setup, I bet you weren't even able to get to a actual correct anchor point.
No, so that's what I'm saying. I had never been nose on the string. It's weird. Like that seems basic, but that had never been something I could achieve.
Because of the bow.
Because the bow wouldn't fit right.
Yep. So you probably also shot a lot more this year.
Oh yeah.
Than you had in prior years. I know you and I talked about that. So,
yep.
So you got a couple deer on the ground. Call them confidence kills, whatever, right? Decent Georgia bucks. And then we go to Kansas. And we have not talked about our Kansas trip because I was so salty about it. We have still not actually talked about what happened. So
it's hard to talk about.
We can get into some of this. And even though Matt killed the biggest buck of his life, gun or bow, and killed it with your bow, mm-hmm. out of state, it was even a disaster for you.
It was. Yeah, I can briefly kind of, we'll spare all the details maybe, but it was one of those situations where we were maybe misled, I think, is a good way to describe that.
I would have said lied to, but okay, go ahead.
And so we were trying to salvage a trip that was obviously spiraling like south pretty quick. it was a situation where I think 2 to 3 days in, I realized that we're not going to have the opportunities for like the big Kansas bruiser that we all want to, you know, dream of. Essentially, we were put into stands. Mike, you were put into, you know, you were double booked into a stand at one point, which is pretty terrible.
Yeah, morning of day one, we got there in the afternoon. They showed us some spots. We got to hunt a little bit that first night. The next morning, I go into a spot and there's already somebody in the blind that I'm supposed to be in from the same outfitter. So instantly I'm fired up. I'm salty.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. What they basically did is they put us in the stands, threw some corn on the ground, just tried to bait some deer in. And, you know, and basically said, that's the stand you're going to hunt all week.
Regardless of wind, regardless of anything, regardless of deer activity.
There was no map of, you know, of the property to show different stands. There was no strategy talk about wind, thermals, any of that. Morning hunt versus evening hunt, access points to get in. I mean, none of that, which is what we had experienced in Missouri the year before, but this was completely different. And so for me, you know, when I hunted that particular stand they put me in, I saw some deer that night. And he said, oh, good, you see an activity. Like, that's the stand you're hunting all week. And I was like, what? I'm going to hunt there morning and night every day the whole week?
That doesn't make any sense. If anyone has listened to the episode we did with Lindsay from the National Deer Association, one of the four major factors impacting deer movement, even after one sits on collar deer, is pressure, yep. Right? That the collar deer shows that it takes multiple days after you've accessed a property once for that to come back to normal.
Yep. There's a lot of things. Yeah. A lot of things went wrong. So for me, what happened was 3 days in, so however many, 5, 6 sits into that of the same stand morning and night, I think I realized the opportunity is not there. And I had seen a buck, I think it was the third day, I saw a buck that evening, and it was way far away. It was 300 yards. I could see it through the binoculars, but it looked good. It's big body, had a pretty tall rack. It was walking with some does. And then he came out the next evening, and you know, so that's
and at this point, I still haven't seen a deer.
You hadn't seen a deer yet the whole time. You hadn't even seen a deer. The guy Minkus, who was with us, I think he saw, you know, a decent buck, but it was mostly scrub bucks and does. It was like just the opportunity wasn't there for us. So,
so I remember we have this group text going, right? And Matt sends a picture from like the day before or something and says, "Hey, I saw this nice buck. He went over here. If he comes back in, I might shoot him." And then the next day we're there and Matt sends Minkus and I a picture. And we were like, "Why are you taking pictures and not shooting that deer?" He's like, "Well, I don't know. It's kind of on the fence." And our response is, "Matt, we're now at day four. Mm-hmm. None of us have seen anything worth shooting. This buck is standing in front of you, and it may have not been a 150 Kansas that you were looking for, but it would be your biggest buck you've got. Shoot that deer." Like, shoot that deer.
Yep.
And I think we initially thought it was going to be bigger than it was because the frame was really big, but the way the main beams curved, it took away some inches and it hurt a little bit. But it was a great looking buck, and we posted some sneak peeks of that on our page initially. But walk us through your perspective on why you weren't going to shoot it, why you decided to shoot it, because we were pretty much peer pressuring you into shooting that deer.
Yeah, I think the combination of like not seeing many deer, the opportunity, you know, seemed like it wasn't going to be there for us. So that the first night when I saw him at 400 yards, whatever it was, he was with some does. So the next day I was in the same stand. It was again an evening hunt. And, I saw him coming in, with a little, it was like a little spike or something. They both came into this little, kind of food plot, if you want to call it that, at about 30 yards. And I was standing up already. It was about the time that I knew like deer would be moving. So I was already kind of standing up. I had my phone in my hand. I was like, I think texting you guys, and he just like appeared right in front of me. And so I couldn't really go to reach for my bow and move and get in position. So I just started snapping shots of him, and I texted it to you guys and was like, "What do I do? You know, do I go for this buck?" And that's where you guys kind of set me straight.
Well, because scoring deers is something that you're new to as well, right? Because you haven't got on a lot of bigger deer to know what they would score. Same for me a couple of years ago.
Yep. Yeah, I was watching YouTube videos on like how to score them on the hoof when I was driving to Kansas and things. But that was kind of a new experience. But it was a situation. It was a buck that if I had seen him in Georgia, hands down would have, you know, taken him no hesitation. But again, good buck, my biggest buck that I've ever shot, and I got the opportunity to shoot him with a bow, when he was in front of me and had my phone out, I was taking pictures and texting you guys, and you said to take them. And something happened. A truck drove by or something. It spooked him, and he ran off.
Yeah.
And my heart sank. And that's when I knew, like, if he comes back, I'm going to shoot him, because I felt, like, regret for not being able to take the shot. He ran probably 200 yards and was leaving. And then the same does that were with him the other night came back around and kind of drew him back into me. They came into the corn, and so he kind of walked in. So as I saw him coming in, I was able to get my bow ready and take the shot. And he was, I think, 25, 30 yards. And, you know, made a great shot, put it right where I wanted him. And he ran through some thick stuff and died. I think he was 40 yards away from me when he died. So.
Yeah, you didn't get down initially except to, like, look at your arrow. And then Minkus and I, we met up, came to see you, and we got to do the track together. And he wasn't bleeding a lot at first. But, I mean, when we say some tall, thick stuff, I mean, some of this, I don't know if they were cattails or what it was, but it was all love 7-8 feet tall. Like it was
over our heads.
It was like a forest, right? You couldn't really get through it. And then you get there, you made a great shot on him. Obviously it was cool to see. We drug part of it out together. And then, that's where some of the outfitter disaster continues. It was kind of odd because I've never had somebody else gut a deer for me, with the exception of, like, my very first deer when I was a kid that, you know, my stepdad or someone showed me how to gut, right?
Right.
So we load this deer up. They don't want us to gut it there because there's going to be people hunting the same property next week, even though they told us they had 30,000 acres and only 30 hunters and never got pressured.
Right.
Still salty. So they take us to this place they call the Boneyard in the guide, I guess you would say, the owner's, like, helper, young kid,
right.
Good work ethic, but just no guidance for him at all. And he has potential to be good, but frankly is lacking in any level of mentor. We won't bash the name of this group, but if you're going to Kansas, just ask questions, right? If you're going anywhere, ask the right questions of, hey, what trail cam pictures do you have? How many hunters do you bring in? How many stand sets do you have? Like, what do you do if the wind is this or that? Just ask some questions. I think for the listeners, it's a bit of a lesson learned. We booked this hunt a couple of years ago. It was before I'd ever been on any outfitted hunts, like, ever. So I think we both just assumed it was going to be good. We trusted human nature, which is sometimes doesn't work out. But you shoot this deer, we get it loaded up, and this guide says he's going to gut it for you. And we're like, okay, like, that's odd, but okay.
It felt to me like it was going to be kind of like the white glove experience. Like, hey, don't worry about it. Don't get your hands dirty. We'll take care of it for you. I almost felt like he was trying to make up for maybe some of the frustrations we'd had. So I was all about it. Go for it. You know, handle the deer for me. He obviously didn't have a lot of experience. He pulled out a, what was it?
It was like a utility knife with a roofing hook blade.
Right.
Not a gut hook, like a roofing hook blade that you cut shingles with.
Yep. And the technique wasn't great. So he was cutting, you know, the wrong direction on the hair, making hair go everywhere. Took way longer to do it. Had to change out his blade and his knife a few times. I think he ended up taking Minkus's knife to use.
And mine.
And yours. You know, didn't, in my opinion, didn't finish the job. Didn't cut out the, you know, the anus, like the whole thing. Was not done to, like, our standards of what I would say.
Yeah,
you know, we expected to be done.
And he did it on, like, the side of a tailgate and got blood all over Minkus's truck.
On Minkus's truck, on his tailgate. Yeah, didn't pull it down to the ground to do it. It was a weird experience. And we said, hey, where can we take it back to go hang it? We're gonna, you know, skin it, cord it ourselves. Like, you brought a huge cooler for us to use. It was like this whole plan that we had. And he said, hey, there's a guy in town.
I even brought my kit to cape it. More of like a surgical blade scalpel type of kit, because it's easier to cape out the whole head because we're traveling across state lines, so we can't bring central nervous system matter, right?
Yep,
so
gotta clean it out.
Yep. We had a whole plan.
He said, hey, there's a guy in town that is the best processor we've ever seen. The meat's phenomenal. He packages it great. It's the best tasting meat you'll ever have. It's $100. Let's go take it there. That way your buddies don't have to worry about helping you. They can focus on hunting. You got your deer. Let's get them on some other deer and, you know, just make it kind of an easy thing for you. And so I was like, hey, no problem. Let's go do that. That way you guys aren't worrying about taking your time to do it. You can focus on hunting. So we drive into town, I don't know, 20 minutes away, basically to this guy's backyard. And, he's not there. It's like nighttime and the guys, you know, it's like everything's closed. And he kind of like goes in there. We ended up stringing up the deer, hanging them up. It took us forever to figure it out, but he ended up hanging them up. The owner came out eventually and talked to us about it. The guy could barely walk.
He was like 120 years old.
He was not in good health at all. And he said, hey, I'll get to it by Thursday. So just kind of check in with me on Thursday. So basically 2 days go by. I'm kind of hanging out, helping you guys, trying to do what I can.
Hang on. He then also said, well, yeah, it's $100 to process it. But if you want me to cape it, it's another $100.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. $100 just to cape it out. And so, yeah. So it was not what we expected. I told him, just process the deer and leave it for us to cape it.
Yeah, we'll do it ourselves. Cape it off at the neck and we'll, yep. And he won't charge us for that and we'll cape the rest.
And we'll handle ourselves. So, you know, I was the next day like washing Minkus's truck and trying to make sure you guys had corn and doing different things to help out. And I think it was Thursday morning. I said, I'm gonna go down there and just check on him and make sure he knows I had left him a note to make the cuts and everything I wanted. So I ran down there and, lo and behold, the deer is still hanging in the same position. And mind you, too, the weather had warmed up. So during the day,
not a walk-in cooler. This is a shed lean-to with no doors on it.
It's in the sun, so it's facing in a way that was basically exposed to sun all day. The weather had gotten to where it reached 67 degrees 2 days in a row. So it was warm during the day in the sun, hanging up. When I got there, the wife was like leaving, and I flagged her down and asked her, and she said, no, you know, my husband's in the hospital. Something happened. We're not touching your deer. You got to figure it out. And she took off. And so I went and cut them down and loaded them in the truck myself and brought them back and had a few choice words with the outfitter, the owner.
Which stuff happens, right? We you know, this guy ended up being okay and we were happy for that. But the outfitter recommended this person. The outfitter said they were checking in and then none of those things ended up being true and was consistent with the behavior that we've seen from them.
Yeah, even the wife had said, I you know, she kind of looked at me funny and said, I called the guy and told him that, you know, we weren't going to be able to
get to it. You almost said his name there.
I did. And so, you know, it was poor communication. He obviously knew about it, didn't bother checking in on my deer, didn't bother going to get it, didn't even tell me, hey, you need to go get your deer. I just kind of stumbled in there.
Because we brought multiple processing kits. We brought our own gambrel, our own hoist, coolers, knife sharpeners,
yep.
All of the things that we needed with the intent of processing. But you said, I'll pay $100 not to make like Mike and Minkus have to take a morning off of hunting to help me cut up this deer type thing.
Right. Yep. And so ended up losing the meat. Long story short, lost the meat. It had sat out for, you know, almost 70 degree weather in the sun for 2 days.
Do you think the cape's going to be okay?
No. No, it did not look good. So I've moved into just a skull cap mount, essentially.
Okay.
Where I'm not going to get it mounted for that reason. The cape was, that was another debacle. But
bunch of hair pulling out.
Yeah, and I would have to replace the cape, which is super expensive. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're just going to skull cap it?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think you and I talked about that yet.
Yeah, no,
that's devastating.
Yeah, it is. This is frustrating.
You can't even do a euro on it, right? Unless you buy one of the artificial.
Yeah, that's the other option. Like I could go that route. Yeah.
Well, and your wife is not too different, and we can say this because they probably won't listen to this podcast, but yep. I think both of our wives are, okay, so you've got these deer, like, does that mean you're done? The freezer's full. And the meat is one part of it, but the meat is not the only part of it. Part of it is just you love being in the woods and want to keep doing it, right? Yep. So to come home with no meat, she was like, oh, great. So we paid $500 for a Kansas tag, and we have some bones that are on a skull cap here that you're going to do
something
with.
Wasted trip, essentially, is what she said.
In her mind, that's you ate tag soup in Missouri the year before.
Yep.
And you came home from Kansas with a set of antlers and no meat. So in her mind, this is two unsuccessful trips.
Yeah, 0 for 2.
So we'll see if she lets you go on any more out-of-state trips.
Right, we'll see.
Yep. All right, so that gets us through, gosh, first week in November.
Yep.
Right, and this is where I think Luke's story comes in here a bit. So you and I, we got a bunch of cameras out. I don't know. I got 5 cameras out at this hunting property that we're in this hunt club that we're both in. It's kind of a cool camaraderie type of hunt club. There's 900 acres, 9 people in it. There's a spot for us to have our campers. We bring generators, you know, bonfires at night, hanging out, hunting together, tracking together. It's just a really cool kind of experience, yeah. Right? So this is our second year in this club. And you're running, what, 2 cameras out there?
2 cell cameras and an SD card, yeah.
Yeah, so you got 3. I think I got 4 or 5 out there. So we got some cameras. Matt and I spent, Matt and Luke and I all spent some time building like a 6x6 box blind in a new area off of a logging road between 2 areas of, I don't know, 6-year-old pines probably. So it's real thick, kind of tall, a lot of cover. Mm-hmm. And we'd set that up, which kind of gets us up to this point. We'd finished that, I think, 2 weeks before the season opened. Or like, what, end of August, early September?
Late summer, yep.
So you started getting something on camera. And I think we'll pick it up there. And maybe you take through why you guys decided to go sit in that place. And then we'll let Luke talk about what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Thinking through kind of the camera setup we had, the box blind was on a logging road. It's got, there's a feeder out there. So we, you know, I was getting some activity at night and things like that on the feeder. It started to really heat up and we were getting some morning and daytime pictures popping up and several bucks. This property's got a lot of deer. It's got some good deer on it. I had set up two cameras and two feeders on two different spots. One was kind of a creek bottom behind this big food plot in real thick woods, and I wasn't getting much there. I'd get some nighttime doe activity and things, but really wasn't much going on there. This logging road had a lot of activity, and we had, I think it was the night before we were going to hunt in the morning, we had some deer pop up, and I had a picture pop up of a couple bucks. One was a pretty nice eight-pointer, and I requested the video. You can request a video, and it pop up, and he was limping really bad. Like his front, I think it was his front right or left leg, I can't remember. One of his front legs was obviously injured. And so I, you know, was curious of what happened with him, was wondering if he had been wounded or something happened. But anyways, Luke and I decided to go hunt with his sister. So he and I and her all went together, three of us. The box blind we built pretty big for, you know, for the kids. So it's large enough for us all to be in there together. But Luke, do you want to kind of tell about the story in the morning when we saw
this? This was cool too, because I think it was the night before that your wife took Luke out and sat in one box blind. I had my daughter in another area on field five, and you and Sadie were in a different area. So we had a bunch of pictures of all the family out, and we both wanted to be in that area and knowing that that buck was going to come out. So I had my eight-year-old, I don't know, 400 yards down that logging road in a different area in a different box blind.
Yep.
So I felt like we were all kind of a part of this. But Luke, yep, go ahead. You guys are sitting there. Walk us through what happens.
So we maybe like 6 in the morning, we drove on our Polaris to this blind, the box blind that we built, and we hopped out. We got our guns, loaded it, but we went there. We sat there for about 10-ish minutes maybe, and we saw what I thought was a doe. And I was like, Dad, can we shoot it?
You were so excited to shoot a deer.
Yeah.
You hadn't really shot anything yet this season.
Yeah.
And so everything that was coming out, you were wanting to shoot. And so what you thought was a doe came out, and you were kind of poking me saying, hey, Dad, can I shoot him? Shoot her. And I looked through the binoculars, and what did I tell you?
It was a spike, and I was like, nah.
Yeah, it was so a little short.
It wasn't, but I think 2 days before that I had Luke out in that double ladder stand behind camp. And again, he's itching, right? He's 11, 12 years old here. I guess at that time he would have been 11, mm-hmm, right? Just likes being in the woods, likes shooting deer, and loves doing that. And we were in this double ladder stand, and these does were out there. And we had agreed going in that the two shooting lanes to the left, Luke would shoot. The one to the right, because I'm left-handed, I would shoot. And the deer come out, he's like, can I get that? I was like, it's in my lane. What are you talking about? This is mine. But we didn't. And you were like, okay, I got a good shot. And I'm like, nope, not right now. We got a couple does. And they ended up being like spikes that had broken off their antlers, because we could see them kind of dogging some does, other does a little bit. So we knew there was something off. But the lesson of passing some deer so you can see bigger and better deer is...
It came to play on this hunt.
It came into play. So keep going, Luke.
And not even about 5 minutes. It was probably about 3 minutes after the spike was like eating and stuff. Not maybe like 2 or 3 minutes. A big four-pointer came out. Like it was, the antlers were really tall, like maybe about a foot tall. Maybe.
Yeah, it was a really tall four-pointer. I had seen them the night before with when I was hunting with Sadie, with your sister. And like freakishly tall. So it looks like, at the first sight, looked like a giant buck.
And it's funky. It's very a real funky rack. Yeah.
And so he, of course, heart got pumping. He's excited. He like threw the scope up and was like, Dad, there's a big buck. So I looked through the binoculars, and what did I tell you?
It was, he said, Luke, how many points are there on, or how many points on one side is there? I looked through the binoculars, and there was like two on one side and two on the other. And I was like, oh, it's a four-pointer.
Yeah, because you have to have, this county has to, you have to have 4 points on one side. Or a spread.
Is it a 15 or 16-inch spread?
15-inch spread.
Which this was real tall, but kind of narrow. Yep. So it wouldn't have met that. And but it's a cool-looking, funky buck.
Yep.
Now, the night before, when you had the limpy on camera, Was this buck with him? Was that spike in that big 4-point in that same kind of buck parade that you had sent me?
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So in your head, they were all in a group. If you see two, that other one might not be far. Because you went out there with the intent of shooting that nice 8-pointer that was, I'm calling him Limpy.
Limpy. Yeah. That's a good name for him. Yeah. He was the target buck we were after.
Or we can just call him like the pirate buck because he's missing part of his leg.
That's right. So keep going, Luke.
And then they kept getting bigger and bigger. And maybe 5 minutes, I'd say. It's after they're both of them were eating. Both of the big bucks were eating, small bucks, and maybe about 5 minutes, a big 8-pointer was like in the field. He was still like kind of looking around on the edge of the woods. Then he came out, and I was like, "Oh, he's a big one!" Like I could tell it was not as tall as the 4-pointer, but it was definitely like wider and bigger. And I said, "Dad, can we shoot him?" And then he looked at the binoculars and he said there was 4 points on one side so we could shoot him. And he said, "Pull the trigger on him."
I actually didn't even look through the binoculars. As soon as I saw him, I knew he was big. Well, because I said, Luke, take him.
That area that he would have been at, what is that, like 70 yards maybe?
Yeah, it's probably just under 100. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I looked through the scope. I took my time. I took a breath. And then I shot him.
Smoked him.
Yep. And it was really cool. So kind of the moral of the story that I explained to him was, you know, really being patient. And it was a good experience for him to learn how to be selective with deer. You know, what came out was a spike. He thought it was a doe. So kind of the lesson of like really making sure you know what you're shooting if you're going to shoot something. And then he got to watch a spike come out and then a 4-pointer come out and then a really big 8-pointer. And we have him on video. He didn't know how big it was exactly. He knew it was big. He said in the video it was a 7-pointer. He's like, "I killed a big 7-pointer." When we went down and tracked him, obviously it was an 8, and it was a really big deer. The other thing that was pretty cool is when he shot him, we watched him fall. And as soon as he fell on the ground, I started high-fiving Luke and hugging him, and we were like celebrating. And we turned back, and he was like getting up off the ground and running into the thick stuff. And I immediately panicked. I was like, "Oh no!" Like normally, if a deer, when you shoot them, they go down immediately. They don't get up and run, but he did. And so I, got nervous and was thinking, "Well, where did you shoot him? You know, was it a good shot? Was it a bad shot? Did you pull the trigger? You know, did you pull the gun, jerk it, whatever?" It ended up being a great shot. He hit him kind of low and back, just behind the shoulder blade, smoked the lungs. I mean, it was a great shot. It happened in front of the feeder and the camera that I have a video. So I requested the video, and while we're sitting there waiting to go down and get him, the video came in. And so Luke shot him. He flipped and barrel rolled on the ground and then got up and ran. Yeah, it was a pretty cool video.
Yeah, he literally like jumped, flipped in the air, landed on his back, and got up and took off.
Got up and took off. Yep.
And so you guys, you messaged me and I said, "Hey, was that Luke?" You're like, "Yep, we got Limpy." We weren't calling him Limpy at that time, but we got Limpy. So I'm there with my 8-year-old. And the night before, Cameron and I had shot a doe. Well, I had shot a doe, and Cameron, my 8-year-old, was like, all loving the track job, like absolutely having a blast. So you were like, "Okay, if you guys will come up here, we'll wait for you to come." So we walked up the hill, right, a couple hundred yards, and you guys were kind of starting to look for it. You'd found first blood, and the area that you were trying to go in at was just super thick. All the kids were getting caught up in thorns. Cameron started kind of whimpering a little bit because she's got thorns sticking in her leg, right? Yeah. And I go to trying to find another way around. I take 3 steps into this. Essentially, it's like 6-year-old pines. It's super thick. And I take 1 step into the lane and I'm like, "Hey, Luke, why don't you come look over here?" And this buck is laying no less. I mean, it went 20 yards, 30 yards into those pines.
Yeah, he didn't make it far. Yeah.
Not even like 15.
Yeah, it wasn't far at all.
So we came up to where Mike was and I got it on video. Luke's reaction was great because he saw the buck laying there and I forgot what she said exactly, but it was like, "Oh, he's huge." Yeah. And you got to walk up and, you know, get to him the first time, look at the antlers, and he was super excited. It had really tall brow tines.
It did.
He had a good spread outside of the ears. He was a nice 8-pointer. He was a good deer.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures now, and actually, the deer, the way the G2's curved, the size of the brows, it doesn't look that much different than the Alabama buck that I have there. Mm-hmm. It's very similar kind of style in the way that each of the, you know, the G2's and the 3's curve in, and it's got good brows, kind of similar, very similar shape to that. So,
yeah.
Matt, what was that like for you? Because that deer, had you shot a deer in Georgia bigger than that one at the time? Maybe close.
I mean, close. I think his was the biggest excitement. Super proud. It was one of those. He had shot two bucks before. He shot a 4-pointer and a 5-pointer, and just like a little boy who's excited. Like everything that walks out, he wants to shoot. And it's hard for me as a dad to tell him no. Like, I don't know what opportunity will be there after. So, you know, he shot those two deer, and it's like, I'm happy for him there. But this was like a learning lesson to, like, really be selective and try to get something that's better. The opportunity is there in that hunt and lease. The hunt club is great. So watching him go through that and, like, pass on two deer to get this one was pretty cool. And then seeing his excitement was made it all the much better.
Because if he'd have shot the spike or that 4-point, first of all, it's not legal in that county. But second of all, that other buck never would have come out, which is similar to my story, right? Yeah. When I shot that one, which we haven't really talked about on here, but when I shot my kind of 124 here a couple weeks ago, he's the fifth buck that came into the field. And there was a decent 8-pointer out there that I was like, it's about the size of the ones that I shot last year. I'm going to pass on it. But I had the gun on him for like 20 minutes before this other one came out.
Talking yourself out of it.
The best way to learn what deer do, Luke, is to be able to watch deer. Sometimes you got to pass deer to be able to see bigger deer. And you never know what's coming up the hill or what's around that corner, whether it's the first doe that comes out. Again, this was November 20th. So even if it was a doe, when him and I were sitting together two nights before, I said, Luke, it would have been November 18th. I'm like, it's November. Middle of November right now. Like this is a good time to be in the woods. If you see a doe, you see this little button buck or spike dog in that doe, if that doe's hot, anything else could come up. We are not shooting a doe today.
Yep.
Right? You want to see a good buck? Don't shoot that doe. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yep. It's about having discipline.
So what are you getting that one mounted?
Yeah, it's at the taxidermist now, actually. They said it'll be ready this spring.
Oh, that's right. You took it up to Rome.
To Rome.
To 8-point up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
I actually requested a mount that I was looking through the scope, looking to see if anything would come behind that 4-point, and sure enough, and it was like creeping his head.
He was in a full sneak position.
Oh, really?
And so we have that on video. So he remembered it vividly. I remember asking him, how do you want it? Like in your room, I was looking at the room. Like, do you want him to turn left or, you know, turn right or whatever? And he kind of told me, like showed me with his head, I want him doing this. He was doing this whenever I shot him.
Which you don't see a lot of those mounts. Like they, obviously all taxidermists will do it, but usually you see like a semi-sneak, quarter turn, things like that.
Yep.
But a full sneak, you don't see a lot of that.
So it's a cool connection. It'll be a memory for him. He'll always remember because that deer was in that position when he shot him and he remembered it. Mm-hmm. So we're getting him mounted in that position. So
it's pretty neat. So we're mid-November and you guys have both shot the biggest deer of your life. Like that's just got to be a...
Oh, yeah.
And 2023 is not over yet, right?
Right.
You still got... There's still a lot of season left. There's more to this story.
Yep.
Because it wasn't shortly after that. When did you go to South Dakota?
It was for his birthday, actually. So it was mid-November.
Okay. So you guys got back from South Dakota, and then that's when he shot this buck.
Yep.
Okay. Which was just really cool. So we had talked before when we did the hog episode that you and I went to South Dakota last year, had a great time, got my mounts back. They're hung up on the wall here. You've got yours back, right?
Yep.
I don't know if you've hung them up yet, but you've got them back. But you said this would be really cool to do with the family. So who all went on this trip?
Yeah, it was a guy's trip. So my brother, my older brother and his son went, who's about Luke's age. And then my dad went and my younger brother went. And then I had an uncle who brought his three boys.
Okay, so how many total people?
Eight, I think.
So it was three generations.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So three generations of the Graziano family kind of all together hunting in South Dakota. You guys get there on Luke's birthday, right?
We arrived, what day was your
birthday? Like a week earlier.
No. Your birthday was on Saturday. We got there on Friday. And as we were applying for licenses, we read that...
You have to be 12.
Yeah. So legally you have to be 12. And it was something the way the law was written. Don't fact check me on this in South Dakota, but it was like the week of or the weekend of was legal if you were turning 12 that weekend. So he was, in other words, we couldn't have gone earlier in the season and he wouldn't have been able to hunt with us.
This was like the first actual day that you would have legally been allowed to hunt.
Yeah, correct. Yep. So our paid hunt was starting on Saturday. It was a Saturday, Sunday hunt. We were arriving on Friday, so we actually left a little earlier on Thursday to get up there early. We contacted a guy, one of our friends, Mike, that we knew in South Dakota. He has a private farm.
Yep.
So I texted him or called him and said, hey, you know, I'm coming with my son, and my brother's going to be with us with his son, and they've never hunted pheasants. have never experienced it, don't know what it's like to flush a bird or identify like a rooster versus a hen. So could we, before they're in a field with, you know, eight guys and it's chaotic, could we go hunt on your land? You can kind of take us out there in a more relaxed environment and just kind of like
teach them the ropes. And Mike had offered that before last year.
Yeah, super nice guy. Yeah. He's a great guy. So he worked it out so we could meet him on his farm. He brought his dog out there and his dad was there with us. Super nice guy too. And so we got to go out there and hunt a few fields. And it was great. We flushed a ton of hens. So we got to kind of see, like, don't shoot the hens. Hens are, you know, they're like a brown tannish color. The mm-hmm. roosters are really pretty colored. So you kind of identify the difference there and the tail length and things. So we got that experience. You got to see it. I think as a group, we shot six. So, you know, we got to come home with a lot of birds that night.
Which in that property is good because it's big, it's tall, mm-hmm. and when they flush fast, and it's hard to swing on them in that area.
It is. And there's something different about it. So when you and I went, Mike, the year before, I feel like the birds were flushing pretty close, like there were some pretty close shots. Mm-hmm. Something about the wind, I don't know what the difference is, but they were flushing really far. So a lot of the shots were, you know, they're flushing too far out or you're shooting really far. So just a different, they kind of changed the strategy on us a little bit there as we were hunting. But pheasant hunting is pretty unique. I wanted to kind of share this. If nobody's ever pheasant hunted, it is really fun. It's a very different type of hunt. It's very different than like duck hunting because you're moving, you're going to them, you're trying to flush them rather than calling them in. And it's considered like a gentleman's sport because you legally can't hunt till 10 a.m. So, you know, duck hunting, you're out there at 4 or 5 o'clock getting decoys set up. For pheasant hunting, you're like sleeping in, going to breakfast, you know, kind of having a relaxed morning before you even go out.
You get your limit by 2 and you come back and hang out.
Hanging out at the lodge. So it was a good, for my dad, who's not a big hunter, it was a good introduction for him. He had never really hunted before. So he wouldn't do well with like the 4 a.m. kind of thing, but this was right up his alley.
It's odd too, because I wouldn't think, like, they will run until they can't run anymore.
So that's what I was gonna kind of talk through this. So pheasant hunting is,
because last year was the first time either one of us have pheasant hunted.
Correct. Yeah. And so we didn't know what to expect. And so, you know, when you pheasant hunt, a couple things. Usually you bring dogs. It's way easier. You either have some kind of retriever or a pointer. And the pointers are, it's a different strategy, but depending on the dog. So the pointers will identify a dog and they'll do the, you know, the typical point and they'll identify like this is where the bird is. And it gives the hunter a chance to walk up and get ready and kind of kick the grass around and flush the bird, but you're kind of flushing the bird yourself. If you have a lab, they actually
You know what's coming.
The labs will be, they're flushers. They're good flushers. So they'll actually get on a bird and flush for you, and you kind of have to just know the dog's behavior to know, you know, if he's on a bird or not. So the strategy,
and you
got
to hope
dogs,
the dog's flushing birds close to you and isn't running 50 yards ahead and flushing birds.
So that changed our strategy when I was talking about they were flushing far. He had the collars and taught them whatever the command is, but he was keeping the dogs much closer so they weren't flushing further. You also, everything's a drive, like a drive hunt. So you have what they call pushers or drivers, and they would form a line that, you know, is on the edge of the field. At the opposite end of the field is, they have blockers, and you usually have two or three of those that are kind of catching the birds as they flush out. And then on the edges, they had walking blockers. I don't think you and I had many of those when we did it, but he called them walkers, but they're like walking blockers. They were, he said, 75 yards in front of the pushers, and they walked on in the edge of the field. So anything
the
flushed,
birds can't go lateral.
Yep. So if anything flushed lateral, the walkers would get them. If anything flushed in front of the walkers or the pushers, you know, they were taking the shots. And then as the gap closed, as you drove, then the blockers had a shot. So everybody had a shot at something, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. If you think about it like a football field, right, you're starting in one end zone, you got the side blockers, you know, 50, however many yards ahead. And then you got the full blockers at the other end of it. And what's weird is you'll flush some the whole way through. But when you get to that last 40 yards, when the birds, cause they'll sneak through all the grasses and they get to the blockers at the other end zone, it is complete chaos.
It becomes chaos.
Because birds start flying everywhere because they have nowhere else to go.
So it's what you were saying. So pheasants don't want to fly. They try not to fly. And it's like a last resort to fly away from danger. They'll rather run. So what they're doing is they're running through the field. And if a dog would get on one, they'll flush them. So you get a few that flush. But
which I wasn't expecting. I think I just expected them to like fly up like a crow would.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So at the end, as you're closing that gap, you're getting, you know, 50, 40, 30 yards. The circle, so to speak, is getting smaller, and these birds start panicking, and then they start flushing like crazy. So it gets really a lot of action at the end. So that's pretty cool. The other thing that's interesting is the habitat that pheasants live in. Obviously, it's unique to kind of the Midwest. The main fields we hunted were cornfields, CRP fields.
Cut cornfields.
Cut cornfields, CRP fields, and cattail sloughs.
Yeah.
And so the corn was not terribly hard because even though the stalks, a lot of them were up,
well, you're walking down the rows. Yeah. Right?
So you're kind of kicking the stalks as you go to make noise. You're trying to, you know, scare the birds up, but you're walking down a row. So it wasn't too terribly difficult. The CRP, just kind of that native grass to the Midwest, that's pretty easy. You're just walking through tall grass.
So it gets mixed with like dirty CRP that's all thorny and
yeah, it can nasty. Get thick. It can get real thick, and the birds love it thick. The by far the worst is the cattail sloughs. So it's I don't think you and I did.
Is it because it's wetter?
Yeah, the ground's wet, right? So it's a low spot. It's moist. You're kind of walking through water, so you have to have the right boots. A few of us did not, so the feet got wet. I had the right boots.
Luke, did you have the right boots?
Nope.
So he didn't actually go through the cattail slough. He was on the edge because of that. He stayed up on the high side. But so I'm not familiar with cattails, or I wasn't before this. It's not something we see in Georgia.
Is it almost like my property in Michigan where it's just all wet, yes, all cattails everywhere?
Yes. So walking through that.
Marshy, so, sludgy, slimy.
That's not even the worst of it.
It takes your boots off your feet pretty
much. It does. So cattails are incredibly strong stalks. So you're trying to put, and it's thick. So you can't walk through a row. You're pushing over and pushing through them. And to make it worse, it was super windy. And cattails have a bulb of dense fibers, like cotton fibers on the end of them. So when you push through them, they break. And these fibers just poof everywhere. And the wind takes them. And you're breathing hard. So it's like sucking in your mouth. It's getting in your eyes.
And I was even on the side. It was the worst.
It was awful.
I was just imagining my dad. Like, I couldn't even see my dad. And he was like, oh.
It was pretty bad. That's funny. And so we had... the guide actually fell in the...
It's almost like a smaller, puffier milkweed.
Yes. Yeah. Like way more dense fibers in there. There's a lot more of them packed in. But yeah, that's exactly what it's like. Because they just blow in the wind real easy. What are those big sprinklers called that track through the corn? They have a name for them.
Big and long.
So they had formed ruts through the cattail sloughs. And they were really deep. So there were certain spots when you stepped you couldn't see. But you'd fall in like to your knee. Our guide actually fell in one. It was a hole that was
because it all looks like a couple inches of water until you step in a hole that's correct. Not a couple inches.
You just disappear. So our guide fell up to his chest, ruined his phone. It was a pretty miserable, like, that one field that we were in. But what's really interesting is
but that's the one you're going to remember. You're going to look back in 10 years, that's the piece of it. The ones that suck the most are the ones that you remember the best.
Well, and the worst part was like we went through that and didn't get any birds out of that field. So it's
exactly. It's like the morning when you and I were in Missouri and my brother Shawnee and Minkus decided not to go out. And you and I were like, oh no, we're going.
The rain.
And we got caught in a monsoon for 2 hours. And it was just terrible. Absolutely disastrous.
What's really interesting is we were looking at it's a pretty fascinating experience when you go out there and you hunt pheasants. And they are everywhere in these parts of the country. Like, there's a culture up there they call it road hunting or ditch hunting. It's legal, considered ethical. A lot of the locals don't do it because it's a little bit more dangerous. People can get kind of carried away. But you and I have a story about that where somebody put a hole in a van, actually, with a loaded gun.
Yeah.
So we looked it up. It's legal to ride with a loaded shotgun when you road hunt in South
Dakota.
That's
absurd to me.
It's not people consider it to be unethical. So we didn't do it. It's obviously it's dangerous. But it's legal. So what they do is in the afternoons and evenings, pheasants just come out of everywhere, and they're on the roads, they're on the side of the road, they're on the fence posts.
And isn't there a rule that like it's like off the main road, so many feet is public land, so you can hunt other people's ditches?
So everything out there is basically cow pastures, and it's all fenced. And so between the fence line and the road is considered public ground, and it's usually a ditch. It's a low point. And they call them ditch chickens for a reason. They like run and flock into the ditches to hide and stuff. So we'll be driving down the road. You'll see, pheasants on the road. They'll be on the fences. And you literally like pull your truck over, get out, and go flush them and shoot them.
You just can't be in the vehicle.
You just can't shoot them from the vehicle, correct. You can have a loaded weapon in there, but you can't shoot
still
them.
Can't even believe that like you're... First of all, if it's legal, people can do it. That's whatever. For me, it doesn't feel like as much of a... It'd be like... oh, there's a deer in my backyard. Let me sit on my back porch and shoot it.
Right.
Right. It just doesn't feel like it's part of the sport.
Takes
of
the
it,
sportiness
you know?
Out of it. Yeah. I think that's why some of the locals don't do it. It's considered, not as sporty. But we did it the night we got in to kind of show my uncle and his kids who have never done it before. Like
what a pheasant
looks
like.
What is a pheasant? Yeah. What is it? So one of my cousins shot one that way. And it's exciting. Like it's really cool. It's pretty, pretty country, really pretty sunsetting and all, the beautiful birds are out there. But what's interesting is South Dakota has done a phenomenal job maintaining the habitat that keeps pheasants there, and it keeps it alive. So the sport is growing and it's doing great. It's flourishing. South Dakota's the number one state for pheasant hunting in terms of density of birds. North Dakota's number two, and Kansas is number three.
Yeah.
Nebraska used to be there years ago, and their government started to subsidize farmers for farmland, especially row crops. And so they've started to produce, obviously it's a big farming state, but they lost a lot of their habitat for pheasants, and pheasant hunting has almost died there.
Yeah.
But like South Dakota, for example, the government realized that it's a huge revenue opportunity for people who come out of state. And I mean,
it's got to be the number one revenue source for the state.
It is. There were studies that looked
at it. Unless you're going to Mount Rushmore, you're not going to South Dakota.
Yeah. It's like tourism money coming in. Yeah. But when it's pheasant season, that state comes alive. I mean, these little itty bitty towns turn into huge hot spots. The restaurants are all packed. I mean, the stores are busy and everything kind of just revolves around pheasant hunting. It was pretty neat to see and just learning about the different habitats.
They appreciate it versus it's different where we live, where there's like, there may not be a lot of anti-hunters. There's some, but there's a lot of people that don't really care one way or the other, and it's an inconvenience to them. Whereas out in South Dakota, they need that. That's what supports their entire economy.
It's a livelihood for them, yeah, which is really cool. So it becomes kind of like a very welcoming town. You know, every town you're in, it's like very welcoming to the hunters and stuff. So it was a cool experience. We had a great time. Luke and I had a pretty stellar last day on the second day hunt. So the first day, he got some birds. I think I shot one or two. You know, we're with a group, and so, you know, we had, I think, 30 to shoot for the whole limit. The last day, we were in this big cornfield, and it was after lunch. It was kind of at the end of the day. Luke was a blocker, so he's at the end of the field. I was one of those walking blockers, walking in front of the pushers. And for whatever reason, every time they flushed a bird, it was flying over me. And so I very quickly hit my limit. And then at the end of the hunt, I'm like walking closer to Luke. The birds were flushing again over me, and two actually came out right over Luke and I, and we got to double up and shoot the last two birds at the limit. So we had a really, really fun time hunting. It was a good experience. Luke, you had a pretty cool opportunity too. We were driving down the road and like a single bird came out, and they told you to get out and go do it, you know, flush it yourself.
Yeah, it was so fun.
You
want to
talk through that?
Yep. Yes, sir. So we were driving down the road, and I hear the driver, I can't remember who was the driver, but somebody said, "Oh, there's a rooster on the road, and in the field, like right next to the road, you know, in the ditch." And so he said, "Do you want Luke to shoot it because it's his birthday bird?" I was like, "Yes." So I got out.
It was on your birthday.
Yeah. I got out. I loaded my gun really quickly and probably put like one or two shells in there, and got out. And by the time I went down there, he was already in the corn. So I had to flush him myself and shot him.
Yep. That's so cool. You walked into the corn and kind of kicked it around, and it flushed right in front of him, and he shot it first shot. So it was kind of his, because, you know, when you're hunting with a group, it's hard to tell who shoots the bird.
Yeah.
This was like his bird. He had the only one shooting it.
So what guns did you guys take?
I brought a 12 gauge that I have. It's a Winchester SXP. A 12 gauge semi-auto.
Yep.
It was kind of my duck gun.
That's the one you had last year.
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
Bought it last year. Yeah. So it was a great, great gun. I love it. And then I have a Mossberg 500 20 gauge pump, kind of a wood grain, real pretty gun. It was my first shotgun I ever bought. And so I gifted it to Luke on his birthday at that trip. So, like in the lodge, he got it.
So you were shooting a pump 20 and you were shooting your semi-auto 12.
Yep.
Was this shocking to you last year when we were out there? And most of the guys that are like regular upland and the guys that were running the outfit where we were at, they're using over under 28 gauges.
Yeah.
Like it just like seemed like such a small caliber.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I get it. Cause you're carrying it all day. It's so much lighter.
It's lighter. The over under is fun. When we were in Kansas, we kind of ended the trip with a duck hunt, and I had an over under and I could see why they do it.
Oh, they look awesome.
Yeah. They're really, really cool. Yeah, it was a good experience.
I was shocked that they were using 28 gauges because I just don't know any better, right?
Yeah.
But after carrying a 12 gauge for 6 hours, I could see why
makes
they
sense
do.
Why.
So,
right.
Well, I mean, I think that gets us like you got a chance to get on another deer there in Georgia. I think it was interesting, right? Because you sent me a message and said, "Hey, got this deer. It's pretty cool." However, once I walked up on it, it was not emotionless. But there was, you were the only one at camp. No one else was there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anybody to kind of share it with, to go on the track with, which I think gets back to, like, we talk about the reason for the podcast and the camaraderie of hunting. And there's so many people that want to be out there alone. But then why, when you do it alone, you don't have anyone to experience it with. What was the difference from when Luke shot his buck and we were all there to when you were out there by yourself and shot a similar quality of buck?
Yeah,
but there's nobody
was,
at camp.
Yeah, Luke will say his was bigger, but they're pretty close in size.
We can measure them.
Yeah, every time you say that on the podcast about the camaraderie of hunting, it resonates with me because there's something about being in the woods alone and just the peace and like watching nature wake up. I love that. There's nothing better. But you can experience that too and still have the camaraderie. So, you know, when Luke shot the buck, what made it so cool and exciting and special was, you know, you helped make it a pretty awesome memory, like the picture taking we did. We got pictures of him riding the Polaris up to the deer, and you actually went ahead of us to camp and kind of filmed him driving up with it, you know, in the back of the Polaris. Like, that whole experience was cool.
You thought we were done with pictures like 8 times because it was like, all right, Luke, turn it this way, turn it that way.
Right.
Matt, get in there. Sadie, get in there. I think all the kids took a picture together.
Yep.
I've done this where I wish I would have had good pictures, and then a month later I'm like, oh, what do I do now? Like, even the buck that I got there, I was by myself.
Yeah.
So I set up my phone in video mode and then tried to take screenshots, and it just didn't turn out great.
But so that was kind of what I experienced, you know, is everybody being able to celebrate Luke and his buck was pretty cool, and it makes it super special, makes it more special. When I went down to hunt, we had a freeze coming in. Our campers were there, they weren't winterized, and this freeze kind of came out of nowhere. And so I went down the night before and just kind of texted the group and said, hey, y'all, you know, do I need to do anything for your campers or whatever? But while I'm down there, of course, I'm not going to not hunt. So I made sure I sat in the stand. So I shot a doe that night. I got in just in time to shoot a doe. I shot a doe in the field that night. And then the next morning, you know, hunted and I had some nice bucks on camera, similar to Luke's experience. I had some pretty nice bucks on camera. The one I shot was the one I was kind of going after. He's a nice 8-pointer. And he came out, I mean, 15 minutes after shooting.
Where were you sitting when you shot that dude?
Same box blind that he shot his out of.
Off of gate 5.
Off the road. So it's pretty cool. It's like I shot the same out of the same stand and the same area that Luke shot his.
That we built.
That you and I built. That we all
built with our own hands from scratch.
It's a honey hole for deer.
It's a honey hole. It's turned out to be one. And so, you know, it was the same excitement looking through the scope. I mean, I'm shaking, heart's beating, the whole thing. Shot him. He ran in the woods, so I went on the track by myself, which is kind of a different experience. You know, when you're tracking a deer by yourself, it's a lot harder. And
for me, it's like it happens so much faster, and my anxiety level, if I don't see blood right away, my anxiety level goes up.
So I did the whole thing of like, I waited 45 minutes to track him. It felt like a great shot. You know, I knew it was a great shot. He did the mule kick, the whole thing. But when I went in there and you know, the blood isn't doing what you think it's supposed to do and it's going in different directions, you start to doubt. You start to say, maybe I didn't make a good shot. Is it really lung blood? Maybe
I get
it's
anxious.
Like muscle blood.
I literally my heart starts racing.
I had to walk away. Actually, I had to get out of the woods. I had to walk away for a second, like reset my mind and go back in. I found him. He was probably 20 yards, but like, it's just that whole experience of doing it by yourself.
And then who do you call? Like, you don't. No one's there to celebrate it with you.
Yeah, like
no one's there to crack a beer.
Right. I think I texted you a picture and was like, "Hey, you know, shot a buck." But like at that point, it's like, well, now the work sets in. The celebration's over. So it's just not as exciting.
And what day was that? I don't even remember.
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Because I wasn't. There's a reason I couldn't go down there to check out my own camper, and I think it's because I was out of the state or out of the country.
Yeah. It was a work day too. I mean, a weekday. So I had taken some vacation to go down there.
Maybe I was working.
Some of us have jobs, but
we both work at the same place.
I know. So it was kind of for me, it was a sporadic kind of last minute thing. My excuse to go down was like, there's a freeze and we got to do the camper. So I winterized my camper. I drained the water out of yours. But, you know, of course, like I said, I'm not going to not hunt while I'm down there. So,
all right. It was, you sent me the picture. Let's see. November 30th. So yeah, we were
okay.
We were on our cruise, probably like in the Dominican at that point.
Oh, so yeah, that's what it was.
That's probably why I couldn't be there. Yeah. But yeah, so what does that summarize for the season? You got a couple hogs between you and Luke. You've got what, 5-6 deer?
I think we put down 6. We had a bunch of does that we put down kind of toward the end of the season to fill the freezer. This season to me was like a breakthrough season. I hunted things I'd never hunted before. The hogs. You and I got on some doves. We did pheasants. You know, I had success with deer early season with a bow, which has never been for me. It's always been a challenge. I had some early success with that. Luke shot his biggest trophy buck. I got shot my biggest trophy buck in Kansas out of state. My first out of state buck. It's like a lot of firsts for us this year. So it's been a really good season.
So how do you top it for 2024?
You know, I thought about that.
You learned a lot from 22 to 23. Yep. I feel like you started really more scouting, more certain trees with cover. I think in the past, you and I'd argue over where to put stands, and you'd want to put them in a wide open pine, and I want to put them in a thick cover, like can't get skyline.
There's been a lot of learning for me. That was something, you know, when I first started hunting, everything was rifle. I never hunted bow. So a rifle stand is really about shooting lanes and like sight visibility and distance. And, you know, a deer's not going to see you at 150 yards, so you don't need to be in cover. And now that I'm much more into bow hunting, my perspective of where to hang a stand completely changes because, you know, I've experienced where I'm not moving a muscle and a deer walks in and I get busted because I'm just open and exposed.
You get skylined.
Versus if you're in proper cover, you can literally stand up and grab your bow and the deer doesn't see you until they, you know, walk out in the shooting lane or whatever. So that's really changed for me. I think, you know, what I was kind of thinking about this. I don't want this season to be one where it's like, I can never top it. This is the best season I've had. But I've heard on the podcast and some guys I've talked to that have hunted a lot, even like you said this before, like there comes a time where things click and it's like, I get it now. You know, I understand how to be successful strategy wise, even like off season work you put in, scouting, things like that. I think it's all clicking now. Like the ability for, you know, us to put ourselves in situations to see multiple deer, to have the opportunity to shoot something big, to hold out when that decent eight walks out, to say like, that's not the one I'm after. You know, I want to get something much more mature. I've seen some mature deer in the woods now. I had one that I early season behind my house on my property was a nice mature eight pointer. And going back to the stand placement, I did all the things right, but my stand was out in the open and exposed. And so he busted me, so I immediately got down and moved my stand like before I even came in the house. So like those things are starting to click. And I think we're putting ourselves in a situation to be much more successful. So I think next year it's building on that. It's having expectations for bigger bucks and just being able to like put ourselves in those situations to be successful.
Well, hopefully, you know, your season this year was kind of like what mine was last year, right? It was multiple bucks, multiple states. I think I had, you know, 5 bucks across 3 or 4 different states last year. And this year was struggling to get on deer because I was trying to level up to that next size. Because last year, the 4 of the ones that I shot were all similar size, but good deer. And I passed on some of those this year. And hopefully next year it's the same. So this year I think I'm at deer 7 right now. But the one buck that I did shoot is by far the biggest that I've shot.
He was a big buck.
Yeah.
He's a nice buck.
11-inch G2s. I was just elated with it.
So, I think he was the target buck for the whole hunting club.
Yeah, he was I think so. Nice they buck. Said it's the biggest buck that's been taken off that property since they've been on that lease in 8 years.
Yeah.
So, I was really happy with it. But hopefully next season is the same for both of you guys. It's, maybe it's not as many bucks, Matt, that you got this year, but hopefully it's the biggest one. So.
Yeah, better quality. Yep.
What's up? Luke's got to leave here. He's got to go to basketball practice in like 20 minutes. So we got to make sure he gets out of here. But I'll tell you what, it was so cool to be able to experience the track in Kansas with you, the hog hunting, and then Luke, to be there for you to shoot that deer and just be able to walk up the hill and do the track and take the pictures, it was just so cool. So I kind of felt the same thing when I shot my buck. You guys weren't at camp, and even though there was people there, it still wasn't quite the same.
Not quite the same.
Kind of like your deer, but man, it is just one of those things where it's more about the people you do it with than it is about, you know, how big the deer is sometimes. So.
Yeah.
Appreciate both you guys. We got to make sure Luke gets to practice on time here, but I can't wait to see what 2024's got. Luckily, hog season is always in season, so we can go down to.
That's right.
We got some rabbit hunting planned at this hunting camp for early February. We got some beagles coming out. We'll get a chance to hog hunt. You know, last year I think when we were rabbit hunting, I got on a coyote and all that. So there's season's not over. Deer season's wrapping up here in Georgia, but we got some small game and some hogs and things that we got to do and hang a couple new stands out there. So there's still plenty of work to do out this hunt club that we're in, but appreciate you guys jumping on. Any final remarks, Matt?
No, I think you said it, man. I'm excited that, like you said, deer season is kind of wrapping up, but there's still a lot of hunting to do. Turkey's right around the corner. I mean, that's going to be here before we know it in March. Like you and I were on we got on some birds last year. We were close. We didn't come away with any, but that was again, like a big learning
opportunity. Did you order the trees and turkey vest
yet? Not yet. It's on my radar.
It is so sweet.
And I think it's on sale too right now. So
I don't know if you've seen mine, but you'll have to check it out because it is, the pockets are in all the right
I've heard
places.
The pocket game is pretty strong.
Yeah.
So that's on my list to get. I've already got the early season full, like everything in early season. So I'm ready for it. So now it's been a great year. Looking forward to next year and continuing what we're doing. Appreciate the brotherhood and the friendship. It's been a lot of fun this year. So
I'm excited for next year because I feel like Sadie's been hunting with you. How old is Sadie? 10?
10.
10. So your 10-year-old daughter this year wanted to shoot a deer, but she said it in the stand when she hadn't practiced with the gun. You said, hey, like, let's go home, let's practice. But next year, there's no way she's not going to want to hold the gun and pull the trigger. So you get to experience this journey all over again. So we'll see what that means for you, Luke, whether, I don't know how old you got to be to hunt alone in Georgia, or if I'm going to have a hunting buddy more.
He's legally allowed to sit in the stand by himself now. He's 12. That's a thing in Georgia. So he may be getting more practice of doing that.
All right, cool. Well, I appreciate you guys. Luke, have fun at practice. We are getting close. This is right in between Christmas and New Year's. It'll probably release early January. But hope everyone had a great holiday season. You get a chance to enjoy the outdoors with some family.
Yeah, appreciate what you're doing, Mike. Thanks, man.
All right. Talk to you guys soon.
See ya. See ya.